Our next speaker is Craig Nister. He's with Knight Piesold, and he'll be presenting on physiography and soils. Craig is a fluvial geomorphologist with a master's degree in physical geography from the University of British Columbia. He has 18 years of experience, primarily in environmental studies related to mining and hydroelectric projects in British Columbia, Yukon, and Alaska. He's been involved with the Pebble Project since 2007. With that, let's welcome Craig Nister.
Thank you, Jane. I'm going to speak about physiography and soils, which are actually two separate chapters in the EBD. Both of those chapters touch on permafrost, so I'll discuss permafrost at the end. The physiography chapter is prepared by Knight Piesold, of which I'm an employee, and the soils chapter is prepared by Three Parameters Plus, but I'm going to be presenting both of them together here. The physiography is really intended to be kind of an overview of the lay of the land of the project study areas, the landforms, the major water bodies, the topography. The soils is based on a Soil Conservation Service, a regional overview of soils, so it's a desktop-based study. But we did tie together some of the information that we learned from the geotechnical investigations that Louise will be talking about in the geotechnical section coming up. And the permafrost, like I say, it's based on a USGS regional overview, and some of the information we have about soils is indicative of permafrost conditions in specific areas. So we'll look at those linkages. So physiography first. The mine study area and the transportation corridor study area. There's the physiography divisions there are shown from a USGS, sorry, U.S. Geological Survey study, Detterman and Reed in 1973. So they're fairly coarse resolution physiographic boundaries. But we have the Nishigaak Big River Hills Division, which covers most of the mine study area. The Alaska Range, mountainous Alaska Range Division, covers a lot of the transportation corridor study area. And then there's a Nishigaak Bristol Bay Lowland that runs along the north shore of Iliamna Lake. You can see the physiographic boundaries are pretty blocky and not a fine resolution. So in particular, you can see the lowlands division really kind of extends along the shore of the lake further to the east than shown along the transportation corridor study area. So within the mine study area, we have the just going to simplify it and call it the hills and the lowlands, and the Alaska Range we'll call the mountains, just to avoid repeating the names all the time. But basically, the mine study area, hills and lowlands, and the transportation corridor study area is more into the Alaska Range mountains. So looking at the mine study area in more detail, there's three major water courses. Let's see if I can move the mouse here. Kind of backwards. Anyways, okay, there. So there's the general deposit location. There's three main water courses that drain down from there: the North Fork Coctuli River, South Fork Coctuli River, and Upper Tulerik Creek. And then there's a fourth one that we often talk about, which is Kaskanak Creek, which originates just to the south of South Fork Coctuli River and flows downstream into Kvichak River below Iliamna Lake. And then in the eastern part of the mine study area is the New Halen River, which is much larger than those other water courses draining out of Lake Clark. And we can see the most of the mine set areas in the hills division with a little bit of the lowlands right at the southern edge. So general characteristics, the hills division is low rolling hills to small mountains. It depends on your definition of mountains. There's definitely small relative to the Alaska Range mountains. Valleys are wide, shallow, with sinuous drainage channels, a lot of meandering of the creeks and rivers within the wide valleys. And above about 1,400 feet, most of the hills consist of exposed bedrock. And there's glacial and fluvial sediments deposited below that elevation in the valleys. There's been some pretty detailed surficial geology investigations done here, and that'll be covered in the geology section, but to give a sense of how this affects physiography. And the relief in the mine set area is about 500 feet to 3,000 feet, that general range, about 2,500 feet in total between the extremes. Topographic features are related to the glacial history largely. So there's glacial, fluvial, and outwash terraces, sort of water transported gravel sand deposits. Glacial lacustrine deposits in a lot of the valleys, so these are basins where water was impounded by ice during various glacial stages. A lot of glacial drift deposits, material laid down by ice. And now there's residual water bodies in some of the glacial lacustrine basins, like Frying Pan Lake is an example. And there's also a lot of kettle lakes left over in the undulating glacial drift. That's an example of the photo at the bottom there. Example of the South Fork Coctuli River Valley, just to show the general type of terrain that we're talking about. So the river is meandering in the foreground there. There's a terrace, kind of a perched level surface of water transported material during glacial stages. And then the hills, fairly moderately rugged, but rounded, exposed bedrock on the tops. Just looking down the South Fork Coctuli River Valley from near the headwaters, and you can see Frying Pan Lake is a fairly large water body, but it's very shallow, only about 3 feet deep. The lowlands, which right at the southern edge of the mine study area and extending south and southeast along the north shore of Iliamna Lake into the transportation corridor study area, is quite different than the hills part of the mine study area. It's very low, flat topography and quite abundant wetlands and ponds. So it looks like this. This is Kaskinat Creek, or as it flows out to the south beyond the mine study area. So getting into quite a wide open plain, sort of in the left-hand side of the photo and extending into the distance. And you can see a lot of wetlands adjacent to the creek. Oops. I went the wrong way. And then this is sort of closer to Iliamna Lake, quite broad, flat, low-lying terrain. So moving on to the transportation corridor study area, I'm going to be using a few of these named features as landmarks, and we will look at a few photos along the route. I'll move from the left or west toward the east, and there's Roadhouse Mountain. Actually, New Halen River, I mentioned before, is a large river coming out of Lake Clark. Roadhouse Mountain is sort of the first mountain that's part of the Alaska Range, but it's really a lot lower, and it's kind of an isolated feature compared to the kind of the more closely packed mountains further to the east. And you can see that lowland extends along the lake there for the first part of the study area. Canyon Creek is really kind of a transition where you get into the kind of the main part of the Alaska Range mountains. And then Pyle River is at the eastern end of Iliamna Lake, and from there we're going to look at some photos looking up the existing road that goes from there through the mountain pass over to Williamsport. and that follows the Chincoyas Creek Valley. So I guess in keeping with what Charlotte was saying about study areas, you know, where the shaded area is the study area, so it is very broad, and we're talking about physiographic regions. But in some cases, you know, where there's an existing road, then we followed along that feature just for our route, just to show examples. This shows just a general overview of the transportation corridor study area. The hills are in the mine study area to the west, and then the corridor crosses the lowlands at first, and then gets into the Alaska Range Mountains, and finally to the ocean near Cook Inlet, very mountainous coastal area. So to start with, from the mine study area to Roadhouse Mountain, we're crossing the lowlands. It's quite flat, moderately undulating. Roadhouse Mountain to Canyon Creek, it's still, we're sort of technically in the Alaska Range, but there's still a lot of lowland area. So that's a view looking to the east. You can see New Halen River in the mid-distance, Roadhouse Mountain in the far distance, and the Iliamna Airport. So just the general kind of low, flat terrain. Once we get to Canyon Creek, then we get into the more mountainous terrain. So mountain slopes and colluvial material, which is sort of landslide and gravitational moved material along the base of the mountain slopes. So it looks like this, fairly steep, rocky slopes with a little bit of a fringe of lower gradient land along the toe of the slopes. Then when we go up to beyond the east end of Iliamna Lake and up the Chincoyas Creek Valley, it's a fairly narrow valley through the mountains. This is Summit Lake, which is up at the head of Chincoyas Creek. You can see the existing road, and you can see the dashed line indicates the drainage divide between Bristol Bay and Cook Inlet. So it's quite a distinct drainage divide, and definitely mountainous terrain. And once we get into Cook Inlet, it's quite a rugged mountainous area. The valleys are glacially scoured fjords, so quite steep-sided, kind of extreme topographic relief. And the shoreline is quite rocky. But we find that the end of the fjord inlets is quite shallow, muddy tidal flats. So the fjords are very steep-sided, but kind of flat-bottomed, and they have these kind of mud flat tidal ramps at the head of the inlets. Some of the information we have from other studies, Iliamna near Williamsport summarizes very shallow. There's been some navigation studies done in there, and it's just very shallow conditions. Inniskan Bay, which is, I'll show on a map in a second, where Knoll Head is, it is a little bit deeper off there, but about 80 feet. Just a close-up showing Iliamna Bay and Inniskan Bay. So Williamsport is on Iliamna Bay. And this is what Iliamna Bay looks like, just looking down the inlet Iliamna Bay towards Cook Inlet. So you can see the flat tidal flats in the foreground. Williamsport's just off to the right. And then this is another view of Iliamna Bay, this time looking up the inlet from Cook Inlet. So just to show the very steep, rocky sides along the fjord. The major stream crossings on the transportation corridor are listed here, and I sort of grouped them into a few categories. The New Halen River is it's a very large lake outlet river. It's a very stable, entrenched channel. And that's just kind of near between the mine study area and the the western edge of the transportation corridor study area. Chicot Creek is a stream on the lowlands. It's quite a stable channel. But then we get from Canyon Creek to Iliamna River. These are mountain streams and rivers. They have very active channels, large bedload transport, a lot of channel instability. Chincoleas Creek, where the existing road follows up through the pass through the Alaska Range. It comes out of Summit Lake, so it's got quite a stable lake outlet channel. And then Williams Creek, once you get over the other side, it flows down into Iliamna Bay at Williamsport. It's quite a braided active channel as well. So that's just a reminder of where those are. So New Halen River looks like this, very large, stable, entrenched channel. Knutson Creek is one of the creeks in the mountain part, and it's got obviously a very active braided channel. Pyle River, very active channel, lots of shifting channels. Iliamna River's got tortuous meanders, so it's quite an active channel. This is Chincoleas Creek with Summit Lake in the top right. So it's quite a stable channel being lake headed. And there's Williams Creek flowing down into Iliamna Bay at Williamsport. And the existing road runs parallel to it, but separated by some distance and elevation. So moving on to soils, the second part. As I said, this chapter is done by Three Parameters Plus. It relied largely on a regional study by the Soil Conservation Service in 1979, Rieger et al., 1979. And this shows the mine study area and the transportation corridor study area. There's a few key soil types. So really in the mine study area, there's two main ones. They're IA7 and IA9. So that's an acronym, but I'm gonna give more of a description as we move on. But basically, there's two in the mine study area and three main ones in the transportation corridor study area, and a few little patches of what they call pergelic soils, which are potentially related to permafrost. So in general, the soils in this region are affected by the glacial activity during the Pleistocene and the volcanoes, active volcanoes in the region. The nearest volcano is Augustine, which is about 60 miles from the mine study area. So that's close enough to have leave quite a footprint in terms of ash in the soils. And the glacial loess is a wind-blown, silty-sized material that's quite prominent in the soils. So within the mine study area, there's fairly extensive areas on the hilltops and upper higher elevations that are just exposed bedrock or felsenmere. Felsenmere is like frost-shattered bedrock. So really there's no soils in those areas. But where soils do exist in the lower elevations and valley bottoms, typical depths are about 1 to 2 feet only. In sort of lower depressions, there can be up to 15 feet, like around Frying Pan Lake. So just to give a range. And there is peat found in kind of poorly drained, swampy areas. So the two main soil types in the mine study area, this is one of them, the IA9. It's quite a gravelly material found on hilly to steep areas. So it's got a volcanic, it's formed in volcanic material, tends to be fairly well drained. And the IA7 is also volcanic ash derived over gravelly material, and it's more found in the lower level and rolling terrain. So a lot of similarities in the mine study area is mainly comprised of those two. There's a little bit of this rough mountainous soil type, which is just quite thin soils over steep, rocky terrain. And the pergelic soils, or less than 1% of the area. They're really just found right down near the mouth of Upper Tulare Creek. These are soils that are representative of poorly drained muskeg conditions and often associated with permafrost. It's not based on detailed investigations to show that there's permafrost there, but there is an association. So just to zoom in of the Minestead area, you can see the HY4 is the pergelic soil. It's right down near the mouth of Upper Tulare Creek. And the other two, IA7 and IA9, occupy most of the rest of the study area. Along the transportation corridor, the rough mountainous soil type occupies a lot more of the study area, 49%. And it's mainly from the Canyon Creek over to Inniskin Bay and Cook Inlet, so that whole mountainous area, it's dominated by these thin, rocky mountain soils. We do find some of the IA7 near the western end, near the mine study area. And IA11 is also another kind of volcanic-based similar soil type. This SO11 occupies 11% of the area, and it's kind of a mixture of some of these volcanic-derived soils and the pergelic permafrost-related soils. And then there's, HY4 is about 2%. Again, it's just small local areas along Iliamna Lake. So looking at the transportation corridor, again, you can see the RM1 is the rough mountain or thin rocky soils, mostly in the eastern end. And the IA7 is mostly in the western. And that SO11 that contains a certain amount of the pergelic soils is kind of in the middle and right along the shore of Iliamna Lake. So and even within that, it's just in pockets where these muskeg soils exist. So in conclusion, literature highlights the influence of volcanic ash in the soils. That's kind of a common theme. And the three main types are these typic crying depths, the volcanic soils, the rough mountainous land, which is thin rocky soils in the mountains, and then that combo that's got the pergelic soil contribution is not dominant, but it does occur. So looking at permafrost then, tying together the information from the soils overview and some of the information we have from geotechnical investigations. There's a USGS regional overview study by Ferriens, 1965, that just talks about this general region of being a zone of sporadic permafrost. It's patchy and complex, so permafrost exists only in specific settings, specifically in kind of peat or muskeg type conditions where there's kind of the feedback between insulation and poor drainage. Most of the permafrost is assumed to be relict from previous climate conditions. The current climate does not support permafrost degradation, so where permafrost exists, it is sort of remnant, relict bodies. And it tends to be under these organic accumulation areas because they offer insulation. That's where these pergelic soils exist. So the geotechnical investigations within the mine study area only, that doesn't apply to the transportation corridor study area. Some relict ice lenses have been found. Certainly seasonal ice is found in springtime drilling, but even later in the season and at depths below the kind of the seasonal frost layer, relict ice lenses have been found in a few instances. Hamilton and Cleaforth, the USGS study of surficial geology, did identify a number of features like thaw ponds and patterned ground that is indicative of probably past permafrost conditions, like recent past permafrost, that's where these features have been created by thawing. So it's kind of right on the borderline of being an area with permafrost, but it's certainly not extensive, and it just seems that it's in very localized spots where, if and where it does exist. So that's all I have. I'll take any questions.
questions? I think we have one here.
I'm Bobby Andrew again. I have a question.
Can you tell us your affiliation, please?
Pardon?
Who you're with. So we need each person's name and their affiliation, who you're with, who you represent.
With the Equoc Village Council.
Great, thank you.
Thank you. Where there's no permafrost, were there signs of spring water or groundwater in the area?
Sorry, did you say where there is permafrost, is there groundwater? Is that the right question? To be honest, I don't know those details. Like I say, this is based on more of a regional overview study. Didn't really have specific site investigations, so I'm not sure those details. I guess in general, like we do know information about the groundwater temperatures in this area, and most of the groundwater is, you know, it is well above freezing year round. So it's indicative in most of the areas that you know, it's unlikely that permafrost would form or persist. But in the areas where permafrost could exist, yeah, we don't really have. I mean, that's not really in the mine study area. The main areas where there could be permafrost is more on the transportation corridor. We haven't really done any groundwater or geotechnical work over there.
Okay, more questions? Okay, well, thanks very much, Craig.
Okay, thanks.